This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support comes from Brian Lowe Financial. 877-217-5757 is your Talk Louisiana number. Our email is talk@talklouisiana.org, and we start with Stanley Nelson, one of the finest reporters in the world. He is in Faraday, where he presides at the Concordia Sentinel. He's also the author of Devil's Walking, about 9 KKK killings along the Mississippi River that went unpunished in the 1960s. That has been Stanley's passion for the last decade or so, and in 2011, the Pulitzer Prize Committee noticed his work, made him a finalist, and best-selling author Greg Iles, who's been with us many times, has based his trilogy of novels, starting with Natchez Burning, on Stanley Nelson's reporting. And this is an important time. It's always important to reflect on what happened in our world not so long ago. But 55 years ago this month, one of the most horrid murders occurred as Frank Morris, a businessman in Faraday, Louisiana, was killed as he was essentially burned to death by people who didn't like him. And Stanley Nelson was the person at the forefront of bringing that story back into the public realm. And ultimately, really determining who killed Frank Morris, December 10, 1964. And good morning to you, Stanley Nelson.
Good morning, Jim. Good to be with you.
Nice to talk with you. Well, let's start with Frank Morris. We've talked about it before, but for those who haven't heard it, or if they have, it's a story that's worth telling again. It's about as bad as you get.
It really was. Frank Morris was a shoe shop operator in Faraday. He had been in business for 30 years, a well-liked man, a well-known man, had a strong clientele of both black and white customers. One night, and it'll be 55 years this coming Tuesday, December 10, 1964, he had gone to bed in a little room in the back of his shop. Early that morning, around 1 or 2 o'clock, he heard glass breaking out from the front of his building, walked out front, saw two men, asked him what they were doing. They'd broken the window and thrown spread gas inside the store. And as he walked out front and approached the men, one threw a match and the building exploded into flames. And Frank tried to get out the front door, but a man with a gun prevented him from doing so. So he had to walk back through the store to get out, and as he did, when he emerged from the shop, his clothes had been burned off of him, and the doctors later learned that 100% of his body had been suffered severe third-degree burns, and 4 days later, he died.
He did live for a few days and actually talked a bit, didn't he?
That was the interesting thing about the Frank Morris case in all of the 60s-era murders, is that Frank was the only person that we are aware of that was able to physically describe his attackers. He said he didn't know who they were by name, but he was able to describe exactly what happened to him. And so the FBI came from Alexandria. There was an agent there who came over within 2 hours after Frank had been taken to the hospital. The agent turned on his old IBM dictaphone and asked Frank what happened. And over two or three interviews, Frank talked about it. He was in and out of consciousness, and he was sedated. So it was everything he said was not perfectly clear. But so that's how we know what happened from Frank Morris's own mouth.
And you happened upon this story and ultimately figured out who killed him and actually talked with the man who killed him, didn't you?
Well, here's the thing that happened. There were, when I started working on the case, we always felt, the FBI felt, that somehow this Concordia Parish deputy was somehow involved in the murder. The deputy's name was DeLauder. And connecting the crime to DeLauder seemed to be a key thing. And I had retired FBI agents talking to me about the case, one in particular who worked the case. He says, if you can ever connect to DeLauder, the case will be basically solved. And what we did in the early, in 2010 or so, came across some family members of a man from Ravel, and these family members said that for decades their relative had talked about going to the shoe shop in Faraday to burn it down, and he was with another man. And through those two men, we were able to connect it back to Frank DeLauder. And consequently, the man that we talked to, named Leonard Spencer from Ravel, who denied having any involvement in the Frank Morris arson, even though his son, his ex-brother-in-law, and his ex-wife said that he did talk about being involved in the arson. He died in 2013. A grand jury had been formed in Concordia Parish to hear the case, but no action was taken by the time Mr. Spencer died.
What happened to Frank DeLauder?
Frank DeLauder died in 1998 or 99. After the Frank Morris arson, DeLauder became involved in the operation of a house of prostitution known as the Moorville Lounge in Concordia Parish that was operated by the Carlos Marcello mob out of New Orleans. And DeLauder was eventually, he and the sheriff were eventually convicted in the early 70s for being involved in that operation. Consequently, DeLauder's badge was taken from him. He could no longer be a police officer. And he sort of struggled to make a living for the rest of his life. And by the time he died in the late 90s, many people, or mostly cops that knew him, said that his last years were terrible, that he heard voices at night, he couldn't sleep. He had gone to a Baptist minister and talked about the fact that he had done bad things in his life, never owned up to the Frank Morris murder. But he did not have a pleasant ending to his life.
Now, Hank Klibanoff, the director of the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases Project at Emory University, says of Stanley, he's a journalistic phenomenon, and it takes a special person to have the courage to go after this kind of a story and then to have the cachet and the background that would allow people to talk with him. And Stanley is that rare entity. I mentioned that Greg Iles has based his work on Stanley's work. And Stanley, those nine cases that are at the focus of your work, how many of them are still unresolved?
Let me count here. Six would be unresolved, and I would actually, you know, you would have to even say Frank Morris was officially unresolved because he was the people that are accused in the case have never been tried, much less indicted or anything else. The stories, though, you know, it's even beyond. Of course, my interest is in resolving these cases for family members, particularly, and for communities in particular, because I think we need to know. The difficulty of presenting these cases now, so many years later, is to find people and to get people to talk and those type of things, but. The one thing that I wanted to do in writing the stories, and I tried to be very patient about it, was I know how polarizing race is and can be. So what I wanted to do was just write about Frank Morris, talk to people that knew him, and let the public begin to see Frank Morris as the good man that he was, the human that he was, and get beyond the fact that he was a black businessman, although that's an important part of the story. But my point was is that I felt like anybody who took the time, who got to know who Frank Morris was and what kind of life he lived and how important he was to the community, that they would begin to care about him. And once you begin to care about somebody, then you become outraged over what happened to him, and then you want to see justice done. And if we achieved anything, I hope it was that, in all of these cases, in letting the communities know what really happened, and this was our background. This is why black people don't have a problem trusting police. This is why communities cannot let these murders go unresolved because it is in the very heart and soul of who they are. That was the most difficult thing to do, but I will say that people were patient and they kept reading, and I'm grateful for that.
Now, as I mentioned, Stanley is the author of Devil's Walking, Planned Murders Along the Mississippi in the 1960s, and we're about to go to a break, but I know you have collaborated some with the students and the faculty at LSU.
Yes, in fact, I'm there this year. One day a week, working with Chris Drew, we have a cold case team there.
Well, we'll talk more with Stanley Nelson about cold cases from the 1960s, many unresolved. But the Frank Morris murder was 55 years ago this month, and we'll reflect on what kind of commemoration, if any, there will be to this fine man who was killed senselessly. Back after this 90-second pause on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle is producing, and Stanley Nelson is with us for a few more moments, the author of Devil's Walking, about cold cases from the 1960s of murders conducted largely by the KKK that were unresolved. And, of course, at that time, the Klan had infiltrated law enforcement, the judicial system, high government positions. Many people didn't talk because that was the way of life not so long ago in this world of ours and in this region of ours. And Stanley Nelson is a Southerner, and I know that you know people who knew what was going on and did not say anything. And it's hard to fathom that happening today, Stanley Nelson, but people were afraid, and in some cases there was quiet condoning of this kind of action. That's just a fact. It's hard to come to grips with that, isn't it?
It is hard to come to grips. And, you know, I do think in a lot of these Klan murders that people in the communities really, you know, they might have known where the Klan was responsible for the murder, but they really didn't know specifically which Klansmen or which policemen might have been somehow involved in it. So, and there was a silence. You know, people were afraid. The black community was afraid of the Klan and afraid of bad cops, and so was the white community as well. And the Klan was very devious in the way they did things. And I'll just make one quick point. After the murder of Frank Morris, there were rumors that Frank was allowing white women to come into his shop and actually have interracial liaisons with black men. That, we were able to determine, was something that was started by the Klan, a rumor started by the Klan, was not true, absolutely untrue. Well, why would they start that? Well, because people who knew Frank Morris, particularly in the white community, they would say, and they like Frank Morris, but they might say something like, well, you know, I like Frank. He was a good man, but he ought to have known better to have let things like that go on in his shoe shop. He was smarter than that. He should have known better. So, and what happens is you sort of say, it's terrible what happened to Frank Morris, but he should have known better. And the Klan was very good about infiltrating communities and how, and putting out rumors that people tended to believe.
David in St. Francisville asks, what local support or condemnation have you received over the years from your community?
Well, we had some initial blowback. Some people didn't like it, wanted to know why we were writing about these things. And you know, there were threats here and there. But by and large, I think after a while, as I said, once they got to know who Frank was, most people became supportive. But there are always detractors. And, you know, somebody tried to run me over one time, and a couple of things like that happened. But I think that was more to scare me than anything, maybe to push me off the story. Locally, it may have been David from St. Francisville that called. He used to be an assistant DA in Concordia Parish and was very involved in working the Frank Morris case. So locally and within the DA's office, we had lots of support. for the case, particularly with David. But, you know, there was resistance. People are, they don't want to talk about these things. But I found the people that raised the most sand about this either had somebody in their family that may have been involved in the Klan or had been a bad cop, and they just didn't want those things being talked about again. But you can't let stuff like that bother you.
Now, 55 years, as you state, next Tuesday will mark the anniversary of this horrid crime. Will there be any kind of activity along Highway 65 where it occurred or anywhere else in the community?
You know, it won't be, Jim, and it's probably something that we should do. We have done some things in the past. And, you know, the thing about it is we have so many cases around here. We had Joseph Edwards who disappeared and hasn't been seen since a hot July night in 1964. We have other cases like this are unresolved. Probably what we should do is have one sort of commemorative service for everybody, because God knows there's a lot we know about and even more we don't know about. It's so much bigger than Faraday, these cases are. But I certainly always remember it, and Frank Morris's granddaughter, we typically talk around this time of the year. She certainly remembers. She was 12 when this happened. But as far as any kind of formal service or ceremony, there's nothing being planned.
Stanley Nelson, the author of Devil's Walking, 877-217-5757 if you'd like to get in under the wire. And a listener has responded to talk@talklouisiana.org and asked me to ask you about this statement today that is causing some strife. Attorney General William Barr is igniting fresh controversy with comments that some see as a threat to communities of color. He was at a ceremony honoring the work of law enforcement at the Justice Department. He said communities they serve have to start showing, quote, respect. They have to start showing more than they do the respect and support that law enforcement deserves. If communities don't give that support and respect, they might find themselves without the police protection they need. This from the Attorney General of the U.S. Critics are calling those comments a threat aimed at communities of color. Do they have a point?
They might, but I think they might have a point just in any poor community whatsoever, and that would include white people too, but primarily communities of color. It could be. I haven't read it. Certainly you don't want to be, I don't think it's a good image for a law enforcement person to be sort of threatening the future police protection to your community. It's something that every community deserves, and they deserve good law enforcement, and they deserve good policing. And you have to find the right people to do that. But no, I don't think it's good to make a threat like that.
All right. Well, Stanley Nelson, we've reflected on Frank Morris, and that was the one that got you started, I believe.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
But then you happened upon several others, and some of those were awful as well. And just as in the case of Morris, people essentially were killed because they were black. And
yes.
And
I'm working on a really one of the most interesting cases I've ever worked on before. Right now was the death in 1965 of O'Neill Moore, one of two black deputies in Washington Parish, in a little town called Varnados, north of Bogalusa, were attacked by Klansmen in 1965. And that case, no one has ever been prosecuted in that case, even though one man was arrested. And it's a fascinating story that involves Governor McKiffin and O.C. Brown, the former D.A.
O.C. was the lawyer for the person suspected of doing this.
He was the lawyer for Ray McKelvin, the man that was arrested, and he also represented other Klansmen in other cases. And it's a fascinating case. It's fascinating that a white sheriff hired these two black deputies and stood behind them. It's fascinating that McKiffin, behind the scenes, was doing a whole lot to try to curb the violence. And there was some successes and failures, but there ended up being 24 or so suspects in this case, and the FBI vigorously investigated this case on and off for a period of 50 years. And it's an example of how hard these cases are to solve. But it's interesting. It's
and
a very fascinating
it is
case.
Curious that McKithen, Columbia, Louisiana, who campaigned on segregation, ultimately became, for his time, a progressive in the South. And the person he had to defeat for re-election was none other than John Rarick.
Absolutely. Who was in and out of Bogalusa and Washington Parish quite a bit during this period. McKithen had some slip-ups. He made some mistakes, but he acknowledged them. But by and large, his record is really good on this type of case.
Well, Stanley, thank you so much. And the book is Devil's Walking. We'll be calling on you again soon. Hope you have a good holiday. Thank you, Stanley
Nelson.
Thank you, Jim. Take care.
Thank you.